Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage, that's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on U.S. agricultural exports are declining, right after this message. Well, back in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to less than 38 days. Now, we Americans produce grain for export, but then we turn around and import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. Our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 population reduction program. Globalization may be good for business, but globalization is bad for you and it's bad for me. Back in 1940, all of us had a pantry full of food to feed our families for a year. Today we have a 3-day food supply in our refrigerators, and we believe in our supermarket system of just-in-time delivery to feed us all. But over the past 60 years, we Americans have traded a 1-year food supply for 3 days. Do you really think that that's wise? Now the global 2000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, plague, disease, and pestilence to reduce Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years, or so says the Club of Rome. And these evil madmen with their global 2000 genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for. And I say let them die for their cause, and then let's you and I live for ours. Now let me show you from the scripture how to be a live survivor instead of a dead victim. To learn more, just call and order my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. You can call right now to order yours, the number 417-273-4967. And the Subsistence and Survival School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Well, international rivals are now shaking the United States and our status as the superpower of agriculture. And it's actually endangering our nation's economic might. By the year 2008, it's expected that America will be a net agricultural importing nation. That's right. You know, for all of my life, America has been an exporting nation. It's been an exporting nation of agricultural products, primarily. We used to produce all of our own oil and export some. We used to produce automobiles and export them. Now we're a net importer of automobiles, a net importer of television sets, shoes, steel, aluminum, airplanes, I mean, you name it, and we are now a net importer rather than a net exporter. The last item on the list that we are the world's major exporter of agricultural products is coming to an end around the year 2008. It's expected that with our imports and our decreasing exports, that in the year 2008 we're going to make the shift from net agricultural exporter to net agricultural importer. I say that's big news, and it is fraught with serious consequences. Take a look at this. From the Wall Street Journal, on a vast windy plain, a farmer swells with optimism as he surveys a carpet of wheat stretching toward the horizon. Bankers are throwing money at him to reap bigger harvests. Grain traders are elbowing their way to his front door, eager to export his wheat. Last year, he marvels, they sold it to the Arab Emirates. This tableau has long been a trademark of the American Great Plains, which flourished for more than a century on an export economy fueled by amber waves of grain. But this farmer, Yuri Bogomolov, is on the opposite side of the world. His tractor is made in Minsk. His seed variety is Don 95, named for a river that nurtured his Cossack ancestors. And the nearest town is Zernograd. That's Gainesville in Russian. Meanwhile, in Eureka, South Dakota, Greg Grintz, retreating from wheat, 7 years ago, he sowed 2,000 acres. This season, he planted only 975. And on the same spring day that Mr. Bogomolov was admiring his realm, Mr. Grintz was preparing to plant soybeans, which at least for now were more profitable. You just can't make a living growing wheat anymore, he said from behind the wheel of his pickup truck. America's run as a wheat powerhouse and the dominant player in global agriculture is under attack from a crop of newly emboldened low-cost international rivals who are striking at one of the main pillars of American economic might, and that is food exports. American farmers are increasingly under pressure as they compete with commodities including Brazilian soybeans, Indian wheat, Chinese apples, Mexican tomatoes, and Caribbean sugar. This farms race has implications that go far beyond agriculture. America's influence on issues such as international trade owes much to its domination of food and food exports. The United States has been the superpower of agriculture, says Ben Percy. He's the director of the Eastern Europe Operations for Commodity Processing, the giant Bunge Limited. Now it faces a number of new powers. The shift is shaking a foundation of America's economic might. About two-thirds of the land in the 48 contiguous states is tied up in agriculture. Farming and related businesses account for about 12% of the U.S. gross domestic product and about 17% of American jobs, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. America currently exports more agricultural goods than it imports, a rare bright spot in the nation's trade balance. Half of America's annual wheat harvest is sold overseas, a trade that's expected to fetch $5 billion this year. I want to pause here and I want to point something out. Our balance of payments deficit is going to reach in excess of $500 billion. $500 billion. So the agricultural export surplus of $5 billion is a drop in the bucket. 1%. 1%. There was a time when America had a trade surplus. Today, our trade surplus is $500 billion a year, and our operating federal budget deficit is $500 billion. Combined, that means that we have a net shortfall of $1 trillion at the national level. $1 trillion a year. Now, there's a strong link between agricultural and political power, and the few farming players are feeling their oats. During trade negotiations last year, Brazil, India, and China rallied opposition to agricultural subsidies handed out by the United States and European Union to their own farmers. That set back a critical round of trade talks. Wheat is at the vanguard of this change. In the 1980s, America controlled half of the world's trade in the hardy grain, competing with Europe, Canada, and Australia. Now more than 90 countries grow wheat, and many have lower costs and closer proximity to key markets. China, in a drive for self-sufficiency, has become the world's top wheat producer and is nurturing a sophisticated biotechnology program. India, A land long associated with hunger became an important exporter 3 years ago when it released part of its huge wheat reserves onto the world market. But it's the return of the Black Sea wheat belt, home to Mr. Bogomolov, that stands as one of the great turnarounds in global agriculture. You see, in the early 19th century, Russia was an important grain producer, but it stumbled mid-century amid war in the Crimea. The United States, with the help of Russian immigrants, took advantage and built a thriving agricultural economy. American supremacy was cemented in the 20th century as the Soviet Union's collectivized farm system faltered and failed. The communist government imported so much U.S. wheat that by 1988 it was buying 18% of America's total production. Now wheat is once again pouring out of Russia in volumes rarely seen since the days of the Tsars. Long a sleeping giant with an abundant supply of cheap, fertile soil, Russia is now putting that land to work through political and market reforms. Combined with neighbors like the Ukraine and Kazakhstan, Russia will supply 11% of the world's wheat exports over the next 12 months, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And some economists see the region controlling 20% in about a decade. Using mostly American equipment, a farm in the Ukraine set the record last year for the most acres of grain planted in a day, 1,413 acres. Meanwhile, American wheat acreage has shrunk to its smallest size since the Nixon administration. The United States now claims just one quarter of the world export market, as other nations with cheaper land and labor become better at farming and take advantage of falling trade barriers. Some economists predict that within 20 years, America may no longer be a net exporter. Terry Zetterlund, the loan officer at Great Plains Bank in Eureka, North Dakota, advises his clients to get out of wheat if they want to stay in business. "We aren't the big player anymore," he says. America's agricultural balance of trade is being pressed and pressured by the country's growing appetite for largely imported foods such as olives and avocados. The Bush administration forecasts that farming's trade surplus will drop to $10 billion for the fiscal year ending September 30th, about a third of the record $27.3 billion surplus logged in 1996. And if current trends continue, the U.S. might run an agricultural trade deficit by the end of the decade. And according to calculations by economists at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, it could come as early as 2008. It's going to be difficult for the United States farm belt to regain its momentum. Despite subsidies from Washington, America's advantages as a farming power are slipping. Emerging food powers are pumping money into infrastructure such as ports and river navigation. In the United States, new land is hard to come by, and farming and environmental groups are fighting over whether to modernize the aging system of locks and dams that let grain barges use the Mississippi River. Many American farmers are finding it difficult to squeeze more out of their land every year. Wheat's average per acre yield has been flat for several years. Agronomists say improvements in biotechnology enable U.S. farmers to better deal with weeds and bugs, but companies such as Monsanto Company and DuPont will export that technology anywhere in the world. In perhaps the sharpest sign that American agriculture is stagnating, the combined acreage dedicated to the nation's major crops slipped this spring despite the broadest rally of farm commodity prices in decades. Even though prices are rising, farm production is declining in the United States. On the southern Russian steppe, just outside Zernonograd, 49-year-old Mr. Bogomolov, points to a field beyond a line of trees. It belonged to his grandfather, who Mr. Bogomolov says was shot by the Bolsheviks in 1923 for resisting their increasing control over farming regions. The Bogomolovs nevertheless continue to toil on collectivized farms after the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. Mr. Bogomolov decided to become an independent farmer and began to accumulate land distributed by the government as part of a privatization process. From his original 170 acres, he has now expanded to 2,470, including his grandfather's confiscated field. This season, he planted about 700 acres of wheat and plans to double that as fast as he can. Freedom, he says, inhaling deeply on a cool spring day. You're working for yourself. Mr. Bogomolov won't divulge his earnings, but says he makes a comfortable income. The tortured history of the Bogomolovs mirrors the saga of the Black Sea Wheat Belt. In the 19th century, Imperial Russia was a titan on the world grain market, with the vastness of its fields making up for farming techniques that hadn't advanced since the Middle Ages. It took the Crimean War of the 1850s to block Russian exports to Europe. That was one of a series of events that gave American wheat farmers their chance to expand overseas. The Black Sea business collapsed after the 1917 revolution as the Bolsheviks tried to harness Russia's peasant farms to power the country's crash industrialization. The numbers are disputed, but historians believe as many as 10 million people died in famines in the 1920s and 30s. Perhaps as many as 16 million died in the Ukraine. When communism collapsed in 1991, so did its big state-run industrial farms. By late that decade, cities such as Moscow and St. Petersburg imported more than half of their food, according to the USDA. Russian agriculture's comeback was sparked by the 1998 global financial crisis, during which Russia defaulted on its foreign debt and devalued its currency. Consumers suddenly found locally grown farm produce priced in rubles much cheaper than imports. Russia's wheat harvest grew every year from 27 million tons in 98 to 50.6 million tons in 2002. When markets around the world increasingly opened to international trade, the Russians found plenty of willing takers for their inexpensive surplus. Last year, bad weather hurt production and the harvest declined by about a third. Black Sea farms are more than most vulnerable to changing weather patterns, and their supplies to world markets are sometimes erratic. Nevertheless, as the market boomed, farmers and trading companies that scraped for cash during the 1990s started spending their newfound revenue on fertilizer, equipment, and land. They found plenty of room for expansion. A third of Russia's arable land lies fallow, and production costs are one-third lower than those for American wheat farmers. The government, which wants to bolster Russia's reputation as a wheat exporter, has supported farmers with reforms such as lifting restrictions on land ownership. I want to point out right here, one of the biggest obstacles to production in America is government regulation. While government regulation has strangled our economy, the same kind of regulation strangled the Russian economy from 1917 until 1990. Now, watch what's happened. With the collapse of the Russian economy and then with the collapse of Russian communism as we knew it under the Soviet Union, they have removed the governmental restrictions and installed a free market economy. If we in America want to become the world's number one agricultural, industrial, and political and economic power, it's easy. Just remove the government restrictions, and Americans will take off, just like the Russians are, just like the Chinese. When you want to strangle an economy and destroy a nation, like the Bolsheviks did to Russia, you take it and you strangle it with regulation. And when you want to free it, you take the regulation off. America is being strangled. Russia and China have been freed. The inevitable and ultimate result of that will be that America will be diminished and Russia and China will be embellished. Now, the Farm Belt's renaissance has attracted the attention of Moscow's millionaire magnates, many of whom made fortunes in currency speculation, metals, and oil. In 2001, The Inturos Banking and Metals Group acquired a company that was once the Soviet Ministry of Bread for an undisclosed price. Inturos spent an additional $20 million buying farms and replacing dilapidated equipment. Inturos found itself butting heads with some Soviet-era habits. Managers go house to house after weekends to get workers back on the job. But the company is nevertheless pushing into new markets. In March, it touted a contract to supply grain to Iran. Russia's proximity allowed the company to undercut firms from Canada and Australia. Tehran's traditional suppliers, U.S. wheat shipments to Iran dried up after Washington imposed a series of trade sanctions. In Rostov, the region's key town, Nevadim Vakulov ships Russian wheat to southern Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. He smiles at his change of career. I carried U.S. grain to Russia from 1985 to 91, he says. In the past 6 years, his company, Aston Agro Industrial Corporation, has invested $75 million in grain exporting. Now, I export Russian wheat, whereas I used to import American wheat. In 1994, Aston took over a bankrupt and abandoned shipyard on the Don River. 3 years later, it built its first grain terminal in Rostov with 40,000-ton capacity. When the 2002 bumper wheat harvest arrived, Aston's silos overflowed. It has now completed construction that increased capacity to 100,000 tons. Awaiting the coming harvest, the new complex glistens in the sun, as does a shiny Mercedes sedan and an SUV. Badges of success for Russian businessmen. We can fill the silos five times a month. He says, we can fill and empty the silos five times a month, Mr. Vikolov boasts. Let me point something out here to you while we're on this subject. Note this down in your notes. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 14. Deuteronomy 28. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28. These are the two penal clause chapters aimed at the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. It also is aimed at the Anglo-Saxons and Israelites of Western Europe, Great Britain, Ireland, and Scotland. But primarily it's aimed at the birthright nations, the guys that have that birthright, Great Britain and the United States. And in Leviticus 26 and in Deuteronomy 28, God says, if you follow my laws and follow my commandments and do what I tell you, you perform on your half of the contract, I'll make you the head and not the tail. Everything that you touch will turn to gold. You'll have the Midas touch. 33 articulable benefits here in Deuteronomy 28, verses 1 through 15. But he says, now, if you don't follow my laws, give me the finger and tell me to stick it where there's no daylight. I'll take all of this wealth, prosperity, and plenty away from you. And I'll bring you down very low, and the stranger that's within your gates shall rise up very high above you and bring you down very low. Now that's what we see going on in America today. It's been going on since 1950, but it has been exacerbated. It's been increasing. It's getting worse. And the reason I point that out is that last week I think I did a series here, a three-part series on the preterist doctrine, where we're talking about all Bible prophecy has come to pass and it's done. No, I disagree. In fact, as I take a look at the Wall Street Journal article, in this article here, as I look at the New York Times, U.S. News and World Report, I can see Bible prophecy coming to pass out of Matthew 24, Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, Mark 13, Luke 21, and the book of Revelation every day. And it's something different each and every day. It isn't the same thing that we're looking at. There are literally hundreds of prophecies in Bible prophecy. Hundreds. Not 5 or 10. Not a couple of predictions about California falling off into the ocean. Why don't you take a look at Deuteronomy 28, just dot that and jot that down. Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26 takes you about 30 minutes to read each one of those chapters. Take an hour. As soon as we get through here, just whip out your Bible, if you've got one. And just read that chapter and see if you can't, as you're going through there, just see if it doesn't jog your mental capacity there. And say to yourself, gosh, you know, that's happening right here in New York. Gee, that's going on out in the West right now, drought. Gosh, look what's going on here. We used to be the head, and now we're the tail. Furthermore, there were, in 1950, 15 industrial enterprises. For instance, the top 15 industrial activities going on in the United States, such as auto production, steel production, aluminum production, aircraft production, and so on. There's 15 of those. Well, in 1950, America was number one in the production and consumption of all 15. Now think of that. 5 years after World War II, America is producing 100 million tons of steel a year, producing 3.5 million automobiles. We're the world's number one producer of airplanes, commercial airplanes. All right. In 1950, we produced 100 million tons of steel, and all the rest of the world combined produced 27 million tons, less than a third what we produced. America was number one in the production, consumption, and export of wheat, and a whole host and plethora of other agricultural products. In America, 1950, we produced 3.5 million automobiles. All the rest of the world combined produced 750,000, less than a million, less than a third, less than a fourth of what we had produced. America was the world's number one creditor nation. We didn't owe anybody a dime, and everybody in the world owed us something. And some of them owed us a whole bunch. Today, the rest of the world doesn't owe us anything. We're the world's number one debtor nation. That's totally turned around. We're no longer the world's number one steel producer, China is. We're no longer the world's number one auto producer, Japan is. We're no longer the world's number one airline producer, Europe is. There isn't anything that we're number one in except debt. We're number one in debt. Now that's a pretty dramatic turnaround in our fortunes, wouldn't you say, in the last 50 years? And think about that as you're reading through Deuteronomy 28, because here's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob saying, you know, you guys, if you don't pay attention now, here's what I'm going to do to you. If you don't pay attention, here's what I'm going to do. And he's in the process of doing it to us. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to less than 38 days, a pretty dramatic drop. Now, the global 2000s, mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians, as I call them, plan to use famine, disease, plague, and pestilence to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years. And it's coming under what's called the Club of Rome plan, one of those international think tanks like the Bilderbergers, the Trilateralists, and the CFR. Well, in Revelation chapter 6, the God of Israel told us exactly the same thing in essentially the same words, using the terms false prophets, war, famine, and disease. Now, back in 1920, nearly 50% of the people of America lived on the land as subsistence farmers, producing their own food and food for the rest of the world and for you and me. But today, we Americans have chosen to live in the city, and now only 3% of us live on the land. In fact, it's less than 3%. 97% of us plus are no longer self-sufficient in our food production. We depend upon somebody else to feed us. Now, we Americans produce grain for export, all right, and then we turn around and import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, and berries from Guatemala. Our food supply is in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 world population control program. This is being implemented by free trade NAFTA, and GATT, the World Bank. These globalists with the genocide agenda have a cause that they're willing to die for, and I say let them die for their cause and let you and I live for ours. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's the step number one to take. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call right now to order yours. The number, 417-273-4967. And my subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct. That number is 417-273-4967. Well, an hour's drive from Rostov, the vast wheat fields welcome visitors to Zornograd, as do a couple of relics of the old Soviet days, a hammer and sickle monument and the statue of Lenin. Zornograd became a showpiece of the Soviet collectivized farm system with help from American sympathizers who arrived in the 1920s with U.S. tractors and combines. Now the town is again in the vanguard of Russian agriculture. It was America that helped communize the Soviet Union, and now the United States has been communized, and the Russians are throwing off communist repression and adopting a free market position in the world and free market economy. So while they're practicing communists, they have adopted the system that works, free enterprise, supply and demand. While we Americans have shackled ourselves with OSHA and the EPA, the Department of Agriculture, and a whole host and plethora of regulatory and bureaucratic agencies. That's what the Russians did to their farmers. They shackled them with bureaucratic agencies. And now that they want to take over the world, now is the time to make their move. Russia and China have thrown off the shackles. Now that they have shackled America, they're throwing off their own shackles and taking over in the world marketplace. Now, an agronomist who works in the town of the Kalinento, All-Russian Scientific Research Institute for Sorghum and Other Grains, walks through one of the center's test fields and likes what he sees. Better crop varieties, better technology, better management of fertilizer and pesticides, and growing technology and techniques. The law of agricultural economics is the same now, here, and in the U.S. They've got one other advantage. You see, many nations in the world, especially the Arabs and the Japanese, do not want GMOs. So while our multinational corporations and our Department of Agriculture shackle our farmers with GMOs as a matter of American agricultural policy, for instance, banks won't lend money unless you plant GMOs. The Department of Agriculture won't guarantee crop loans or insurance, crop insurance, without GMOs. You have to follow the policy. Government sets the policy. The bureaucracy sets the policy, and the multinational corporations set the policy for the government. What Monsanto wants, the Department of Agriculture demands of the farmers in Iowa. And if the farmers in Iowa won't comply with the Department of Agriculture, they're on their own. And they can't compete. So they have to knuckle under. So they follow the policies of the Department of Agriculture, which are bankrupting American agriculture, which was the design modality from the 1920s. It has been from day one, 1933, with Franklin D. Roosevelt, to destroy the United States economy, to destroy agriculture in America, and put America into the New World Order. To do that, you have to break us. And they have. They are. They did. They will. It's an accomplished fact. They just haven't announced it to you yet. but they will shortly. In America, very few wheat farmers understand the challenges posed by Russia's rebirth as a food power any better than Mr. Grentz and the farmers around Eureka, population 1,100. Eureka, North Dakota, lies on a similar latitude to Rostov, close to the 45th parallel. Both towns have fashioned icons to the local economy. Zernograd's museum doubles as a hall of fame for its wheat farmers. Eureka has a monument to wheat in front of its museum. "We never thought Russia could come back," says Mr. Grintz. "We always looked at them as our customer. Now, out of a clear blue sky, they're producing crops that we didn't dream they could produce. And it wasn't long ago that Eureka's families worked the Black Sea soil. Many of their great-great-grandfathers were part of a tide of wheat farmers that moved to the plains of America from the Russian steppes in the 1880s. Fleeing conscription in Russia's imperial military, the United States federal government offered 160 acres of land for these homesteaders fleeing Russia. On the harsh fringe of the American breadbasket, where nobody else wanted to live, North and South Dakota and Montana, where blizzards rule the winter and drought haunts the summer. Now, based on the experience in Russia, the new arrivals knew how to grow the one crop hardy enough to survive in this harsh environment. By 1892, the fledgling town was booming. Eureka produced so much wheat that in order to transport it in one shipment would have required a train 30 miles long. Farmers piled wheat in the streets until it could be transported elsewhere, and with hotels jammed, many slept on store floors or patronized all-night saloons. America's amber waves of grain, enshrined in the second line of the late 19th century anthem America the Beautiful, became an instrument of foreign policy. The United Kingdom didn't side with the Confederacy during the Civil War, in part because it needed the North's wheat more than they needed the South's cotton. After the Russian Revolution, when the country's farm belt declined, generations of farmers across the Great Plains prospered by shipping their crops there, and wheat again became intertwined with politics. After the 1979 Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Carter administration embargoed U.S. grain exports to the Soviet Union. President Reagan scrapped the ban in 1981 after farm groups complained that competing exporters were simply filling the void. 2 years ago, the U.S. wheat harvest was stunted by drought, and at the same time, the Black Sea region, comprising Russia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan, stunned the American farm belt by temporarily surpassing the U.S. as a wheat exporter. It hasn't repeated that feat, but USDA economists say Russia's wheat production could soar 30% within a decade if it adopts further reforms. That would pressure U.S. exports in places like the Middle East. Now, you just picture this. Do you think that the Arabs in the Middle East, if they had a choice of buying grain from Russia or the United States, would buy it from us as opposed to the Russians? No, I tell you, boys and girls, the Arabs would go without bread rather than buy it from us. And it's going to come back to haunt us. But it's not the Russians. It's not the Arabs. It's you and I. You see, you and I are in violation. We are in breach of contract. You and I have a contract with our God, and we breach the contract. And now it has triggered the penal clause to the contract. That contract is located, just in case you wanted to look it up, in Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8. So jot that one down. It's Exodus 19, verse 16, through Exodus 24, verse 8. There's the Old Covenant. There's the contract. And your great-great-great-great-great-granddaddy, 84 generations ago, that's 84 times 40, 40 years to a generation, made an agreement which is summed up in Exodus 24, verse 7 and 8, where he said, "All that the Eternal has said, we will do and be obedient." But in 1947, we began a long series of events 1947 to 62, in which we took that contract and we discarded it. That contract recorded in our Bibles. We took it out of our public schools. We took it out of our public institutions. We took it out of our national consciousness. We took that contract, tore it up, and told God to stick it where there's no daylight. 1947 was the first case decided. 1962, that's when we banished prayer in our public schools. I mentioned the other day that we could turn this thing around, we Americans, if we so desired, but we don't, and we won't, and we haven't, and we're not about to. And the Apostle Paul made an observation. He said in Romans 8, verse 7, he said, "The carnal mind is enmity against God. It isn't subject to the law of God, and neither indeed can be." That's simply a statement of fact taken after the fact from 1 Samuel chapter 8, in which we the Americans and Britons and Australians and New Zealands, years ago gave God the finger when we were still in the Middle East, when we were still living in Syria and Palestine, and we told God that we wanted a king like all the nations around us and that he could take his law and stick it where there's no daylight. And he did. He said, "Okay, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success." You can read that. That's the biggest event in geopolitical history for Anglo-Saxons. It's 1 Samuel chapter 8, 22 verses. And in that chapter, about verse 18 or 19, God made this statement. He said, "In that day," for you preterists out here, he said, "In that day, you will cry out to me because of the king that you have set over you." Kings that we set over us. Kings that we elect president and prime ministers of our nations. And he said, "When you cry out to me, I will not hear you." So for all you religious folks out there that want to pray to Jesus, he just told you, you can pray until hell freezes over and the cows come home, but I ain't hearing this crap. Save your breath. Now, there's a remedy to our dilemma. There's a remedy. And you have to go back to the contract. Now, the majority of Americans are not going to go back and practice the contract. But when you get your belly full and you've had enough, and you decide that, well, maybe there's a better way to live. Maybe there's more money to be made under the terms of our old contract than there is under Social Security, welfare, and unemployment insurance. You'll find that contract, remember, in Exodus 19:16 through Exodus 24:8, and the benefits that flow from it in Exodus, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. Now, going on, they tell us that growing wheat is now a riskier proposition for American farmers. You see, in the past, the United States controlled such a large chunk of the world's exports that the quality of its harvest had a big influence on prices. A drought in the United States, for example, would create a worldwide shortage and push up the cost of wheat, mitigating losses for U.S. farmers. Now, we don't have that leverage. Some farmers in Eureka, North Dakota, are switching to corn and soybeans, and these crops are harder to grow, requiring more money, more water, more skill. They're also not immune to foreign competition. You see, the United States corn industry is healthy, but Brazilian soybean sales are rising, and they're rising so fast that they will likely overtake U.S. exports in just a few years. Fertile land is so cheap in Brazil that some American farmers are migrating to Brazil, closing up shop in the United States and going to Brazil. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School here in Isabella, Missouri. The genocidal policy of Global 2000 and this New World Order are the greatest threats to our lives, our liberties, and our property since Noah's flood. Now, our national leaders have subscribed to a plan created by the Club of Rome, the United Nations, the Trilateral Commission, and a whole host and plethora of other lesser policy-making think tanks to reduce the Earth's population by 90% over the next 50 years. That's correct. That's 90% over the next 50 years. That's mind-boggling. That's genocide on a scale that's never been experienced on this planet before. And it fits right in with Bible prophecy. Now, let's not delude ourselves into believing that we're going to stop all of these mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians in their insane scheme to enslave the world and impose a worldwide tyranny, a new world order upon all of us. But you and I do not have to participate in our own demise. We don't have to help them. We don't have to help finance them. We don't have to stand helplessly by and do nothing either. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I wise up and start listening more to the God of Israel and stop following after all these crazy politicians, scientists, preachers, philosophers, and let you and I prepare to live through and survive this global 2000 New World Order nightmare. And for you to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. And my subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for the free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, this spring, Dean N. Shoemaker, he's 54, planted the smallest amount of wheat ever on his farm. The wheat belt is dying, says the fourth generation descendant of Russian immigrants, as he stands near his idling tractor. Banking on China's growing appetite, he's growing 746 acres of soybeans this year, compared with just 358 acres of wheat. For now, an acre of soybeans could generate twice as much revenue as wheat. Now, for some local merchants, the initial flush of spending by farmers making the switch is good business. Dwayne Weishauer, he's the owner of Haberer's Implement Incorporated in nearby Bodle, says that he sold 12 tractors so far this year, compared with just one tractor in all of 2003. He's also selling machine parts to harvest corn and soybeans, and figures only about 25% of his business is now tied to wheat. Now let me tell you a little story here about soybeans. The Brazilians have been increasing soybean acreage by a million acres per year, every year for the last 13 years. They've got 13 million acres into production that they didn't have 13 years ago. And they can produce soybeans a lot cheaper than in America, so cheap that in the East, they just build a port to handle ships. A port to handle ships in North Carolina. I reported this to you. Shortly, you soybean farmers who are right now experiencing a rush of productivity and profitability in soybeans, shifting from wheat to soybeans. Now, you long-time soybean farmers, long-timers, are going to have to meet this competition. The wheat farmers are going to be growing soybeans in America. The Brazilians are going to be growing soybeans in Brazil. They're increasing at a faster pace than anybody in the world. The Chinese and others around the world are growing more and more soybeans. And pretty soon the soybean market, just like the wheat market, is going to go south in America. How do I know that? I know it because of Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. You see, this isn't being done to us, boys and girls, by the Russians or the Brazilians. It's being done to us by God Almighty Himself, using the Russians and the Brazilians to accomplish His goal. You see, the Crimean War in the 1850s shut off Russian wheat exports and opened up America. God opened His hand in the 1850s and shut off the Russians and opened up the Great Plains for Americans. That was the blessings. That was the period of time for the next 100 years that we Americans would be blessed. And we were. We were entitled to it. We had a contract that guaranteed it. God fulfilled his end of the contract. We got our benefits. We didn't fulfill our end of the contract. Now the benefits are being taken away. They're going to be given to the Brazilians and the Russians and the Chinese for a while, until he breaks our back, destroys our economy, destroys our nation, and sends us into abject poverty. Well, that's what he says he's going to do. You take a look at it for yourself. Remember, I told you where the two sources were. It's Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. As they say down at the Blue Room, read them and weep, as the dealer deals the cards. Now, for others, the winnowing of the wheat economy is creating hard choices. Farmer Jim Fisher, 48, grows and sells wheat seed around Eureka. He cut his wheat acreage by 20% this spring, and he's traveling further to find customers. Some companies are getting out of the wheat business entirely. Monsanto, the St. Louis crop biotechnology company, cited the drop in wheat acreage as a big factor in its decision to shelve plans to introduce the world's first genetically modified wheat plant. Now, that is the best news that we've heard so far. You see, they genetically modified the soybeans and the corn. The Japanese won't let those products in. Those of us that are into health foods here in America won't buy them. For instance, when I go to the health food store to buy mayonnaise, I don't buy Kraft mayonnaise. I used to buy Kraft mayonnaise. But you see, now more than half the soybean crop is genetically modified, so I won't buy Kraft. I only buy mayonnaise that I know isn't made from genetically modified soybeans. About 12% of Americans are doing the same thing. That doesn't have any influence whatsoever on Kraft, but it has a lot of influence on America's soybean farmers. You see, when 12% of us say, we're not going to buy your soybeans because they're genetically modified, the price drops. And so the companies that want to make sure that the soybeans that they're using are not genetically modified, they pay more money, and I pay more money, for the mayonnaise that I buy in the health food store. And you're sitting there saying, well, that's good for us. And I'm not quite sure that that's true, because, you see, you can buy soybeans from Brazil now imported into the United States. There was a time when we were a net exporter. Now we're no longer the big net exporter that we used to be. We're still an exporter. Yep, we're still an exporter. But now we've got competition. And the competition comes from people that can say, we've got open pollinated seeds. And that's where I'm buying mine. And the manufacturers that are buying aren't buying your seed from Monsanto. Same thing with corn. I used to feed corn to my chickens and my cows. I used to buy it over here at the local feed store. Corn. I changed to oats. And that's because corn is genetically modified. Or there's so much of it that is genetically modified that I can't control it. I can't determine that. I can no longer get my feed company to guarantee that the corn that they're bringing in is not genetically modified. So I said, that's fine. No problem. I won't buy corn. Period. Now you see, I'm just a small guy. And if I were a bigger operator, I would buy corn by the semi-load. I would find open pollinated seed, and I'd just buy a whole semi-load and put it in my silo. But I can't do that now. I can't do it because I'm not big enough to buy a semi-load, and my feed dealer can't guarantee that he can give me open pollinated seed, so I solve the problem, and so do millions of little farmers all over America just like me. We just don't buy corn. We use something else we feed our chickens oats or barley, or we feed them something else like Milo, in order to avoid. Now, I'll buy wheat because the wheat in America hasn't been genetically modified yet. But it doesn't do any good for you wheat farmers out there because the wheat is going to be, and get this, one of these days you'll see wheat being imported into the United States. When we're producing wheat for $3 or $4 a bushel and the Russians can produce it for $2.50, that's a simple no-brainer. We'll just import wheat from overseas until such time as our wheat infrastructure is totally destroyed. And when our economy collapses and we don't have the money to pay for the wheat, they won't send us the wheat. And we won't be able to produce it ourselves, and we won't be able to buy it either. That's where we're headed. That's what the game plan calls for. Destroy the American infrastructure so they can't produce the wheat themselves. Then destroy their economy so that they can't buy it. Now go back to Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26 and see what this famine that's coming upon us is going to do to us. Famine. Towns giving up on wheat will be more vulnerable to the fickle weather patterns. Mr. Shoemaker's farm, for example, usually averages just 17 inches of rain annually, barely enough for a crop of soybeans. There isn't a river or underground aquifer for irrigation water. And last year, when Eureka suffered through a dry August, farmers ended up with a soybean crop a quarter of the size that they had anticipated. Go back to Deuteronomy 28 again and look at the word drought. I'll turn your heaven to iron. To husband a thirsty crop in an arid climate, Mr. Shoemaker practices no-till farming, which means he doesn't turn over the soil for planting. Instead, he plants directly into last year's stubble. The old plants hold the dirt in place and prevent the wind from taking the topsoil, retaining moisture. So Shoemaker figures that stretches out his annual rainfall by the equivalent of another 2 or 3 inches. How far will the American wheat belt shrink? Well, some parts of the Great Plains will continue to plant wheat simply because nothing else will grow there. Regions including eastern Montana and western Kansas face a future of lower prices and thinner profits. By shifting away from wheat to more weather-sensitive crops, farmers are taking bigger risks to stay on the land. And as a result, farmers are becoming wedded to federal aid, such as subsidized crop insurance, at a time when Washington is under pressure to cut farm assistance. So Mr. Grants, who figured that he reaps as much as 40% of his income from government farm programs, talks proudly about his 26-year-old son, a data programmer who has worked for International Business Machines Corporation. He doesn't mind that his son's career choice will likely end a bloodline of farmers stretching back 4 generations to Russia. Farming is only getting riskier, says Grants, 56, as he scouts the progress of his fields in his pickup truck, and I don't have any romantic notions about it. Well, that's the penalty that we pay, boys and girls, the penalty that we pay for the violation of the terms and conditions of the contract. All right, I'm about out of time for this week. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call the Law School at 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. Well, there's the signal that says our time is up. We'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.